Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Hot and dry weather in Northern California continues to complicate efforts to contain the Carr wildfire. It's already burned more than 98,000 acres as of this morning. The fire has also killed at least six people, forced the evacuation of tens of thousands, and destroyed hundreds of homes. But firefighters say they're making progress. Danielle Venton joins us now for an update. She's a reporter for KQED. Hi there, Danielle.
Hello, Meghna.
Now, I understand you're in Redding, California, near the heart of this fire. What's the scene like there today?
You know, it's another day of extreme smoke. The sun rose this morning a deep orange color. Air quality is really bad. People are feeling a mixture of gratitude for the work that the firefighters are doing, some frustration in wanting to return home and wanting to know what's happened to their property. There's also a lot of people volunteering and just trying to get this community back to normal. I will say firefighters are incredibly sad. They learned yesterday about the death of another firefighter near Yosemite. And at the daily briefing this morning, just south of Redding, where the operations are centered, there was a moment of silence for 33-year-old Brian Hughes, who died battling the Ferguson fire. Cal Fire has some peer support programs where firefighters can talk through their experiences. And we have some tape of how Michael Ming, he's a deputy fire chief with Cal Fire, described it.
Just sitting and listening to somebody and validating their experience and just not fixing them, but just listening and validating their experience and let them tell their story, get it off their chest, so to speak.
Well, Danielle, earlier today, the State Fire Authority, Cal Fire, released its latest numbers on what's been going on. This fire has burned more than 98,000 acres already and is just 20% contained. I mean, what are firefighters saying about how hard it is or the efforts they have to make for containment?
Well, firefighters worked through the night. They've been working through every night to build control lines. They did make a lot of progress. You know, 20% is quite a jump from just 5%, which we were seeing 2 days ago.
Yeah.
Most of the containment is between the fire and the city limits of Redding. Fire did expand last night, but it's in areas that are very rural where there aren't too many homes. They have a lot more to do, but you know, they're hoping that they're finally getting the upper hand. There was a red flag warning in place, which means conditions are ideal for really rapid, uncontrolled spread of fire. And that expired this morning, and it's not expected to go back into place, at least not right now.
I see. Now, I understand this fire is so intense that it's generating its own weather system. I mean, some people are calling this a fire tornado. What is that?
Yeah, you know, the fire started a whole week ago. It burned in a pretty controlled manner until late last week, when Thursday night it generated this enormous fire tornado. There's an estimation that it was maybe a quarter of a mile across. It's pretty common to see small-scale fire whirls during fires. Think of like dust devils. But it's pretty rare to see these tornado-scale fire tornadoes. I spoke with fire meteorologist Alex Hoon, and he says that there's some combination of terrain, fuels, and weather that makes a cycle of just churning air rotate and get stronger. And here's how he described it.
It's almost like a living, breathing, fire-breathing giant. It's literally feeding itself in this mechanism until something stops.
Until something stops. Wow. Yeah. Well, so mandatory evacuations are forcing, what, tens of thousands of people to have to leave their homes. How is that being handled?
That is being handled. People are staying with friends or with family. There are five different evacuation centers in the area, two at colleges, two at high schools, one at a church. The Red Cross is taking a leading role in organizing those efforts.
Okay. President Trump has issued an emergency declaration over the weekend that's allowing counties in California affected by these fires to receive some federal assistance. I mean, how much damage has there been, and do we know what recovery might look like?
Well, recovery is going to take a really long time.
Yeah.
You know, there's more than 700 homes destroyed. There's many more. There's others that are damaged. People's businesses are disrupted. Cleanup is going to take months, and rebuilding is going to take years.
Okay. Well, finally, I guess the inevitable question, what's the forecast in the next couple of days? Any relief in sight?
Not really. It's going to stay very hot. It's supposed to be 108 today. Triple digits are expected until Sunday. The humidity will be slightly higher. That may help firefighters. But there's a chance that this behavior where the fire sort of takes control and moves unexpectedly and blows out of control, that could happen again.
Mm. Well, that's KQED reporter Danielle Venton speaking to us from Redding, California. Danielle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today, President Trump tweeted about immigration and the need for a wall on the Mexican border, but he did not repeat his threat from yesterday to shut down the government in September if he doesn't get the funding for that wall. Meanwhile, the trial of former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort begins this week. So let's get a look at the week ahead in Washington with NPR White House reporter Ayesha Roscoe. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with Trump's government shutdown threat. Leading Republicans backed away from it on the Sunday talk shows yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation. Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson was asked whether we should expect a shutdown.
Let's hope not. I think hopefully most of the appropriation bills will actually be passed. A little better prioritization of spending. So I certainly don't like playing shutdown politics.
Are Republicans, who we should remember have full control of Congress right now and the White House, are they panicked about the idea of a shutdown?
They would be worried about if a shutdown actually happens. And I think what is also worrying for Republicans is that President Trump has been not really clear on his messages. So yesterday he's talking about a shutdown. Sometimes he'll go back and say, no, a shutdown is not good. But he has been known to kind of go back on what he says. And so the Republicans, they do not want this to happen right before midterms when they control Congress, control the White House, because they feel like they're going to be blamed for it.
Right. President Trump also on Twitter disclosed a meeting that he had recently with the New York Times publisher A.G. Sulzberger, which the White House had asked to be kept private. And then Trump tweeted about it. He said their conversation was about fake news that he doesn't like and, quote, how that fake news has morphed into the phrase enemy of the people, which is a phrase that he has used to describe the media. What's going on here?
It seems like President Trump, for whatever reason, wanted to bring this issue up. Maybe he wanted to focus on his fights with the media. That's a very comfortable place for him. Sulzberger, in response to what President Trump said and him talking about the meeting, basically said that he was telling President Trump that this is dangerous rhetoric, especially when you move to this point of calling the press the enemy of the people. But Trump really seems to relish this kind of fight with the press. And I think he feels like it plays well to his base.
What about the Manafort trial? The jury selection starts tomorrow in the financial crimes trial of the former Trump campaign manager. He faces charges of laundering more than $30 million in political consulting that he did for Ukraine's former pro-Russian leader. But Russia is unlikely to come up in this trial, even though Manafort has also been indicted in the FBI's Russia investigation. Explain that.
No, so prosecutors have said that they don't plan on getting into this issue of possible collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians in this trial. Instead, they're focused on that tax fraud and money laundering and those charges with Manafort, and much of that preceded the campaign. And so this is focused on kind of other accusations of wrongdoing against Manafort.
On CNN this morning, Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, was asked about the kind of relationship that Trump had with Manafort in 2016 when Manafort ran the campaign for a few months. Here's Giuliani.
4 months, they're not going to be colluding about Russians, which I'm not even know if that's a crime, colluding about Russians.
Now, that was new for him to say that he doesn't think that colluding with Russians is a crime.
That is definitely moving the goalposts. You're basically saying, well, maybe if there was collusion, is that even a crime? Is that something legally wrong with that? So you definitely see maybe Giuliani is trying out different messages to see what sticks and what might work. But it is interesting that now they're raising questions about, well, is collusion really that wrong?
How worried is the White House right now about this Manafort trial and the Russia investigation in general?
I think as far as the Manafort trial, what they will say is this has nothing to do with the campaign. And this shows that maybe Mueller is kind of digging up dirt that doesn't have to do with President Trump. But overall, just this, the having this cloud of the Mueller investigation and not knowing what's going to come next, that is something that is definitely hanging over this White House. And I think that's why you see President Trump tweeting about this so much and basically calling it a scam and a quote unquote a witch hunt.
The other thing hanging over this White House and hanging over all of the politicians in Washington right now is, as you've mentioned, the midterm elections coming up now 99 days away. Where are we with that at this point in terms of how each party feels, how the Democrats feel, how the Republicans feel, and whether they want to, the Republicans, that is, stand with Trump or just try to campaign on their own?
Republicans are probably feeling a bit worried because of the polling that's showing Democratic enthusiasm, but they're sticking with Trump. I think they feel like they're kind of they're stuck with Trump in the sense that he's very popular within their party. And so as he goes, so do they. And so I think that they are sticking with President Trump. And I think that a lot for Democrats, I think even though there is this resist movement, a lot of times on the trail, Democrats seem to be focusing their message on their area and doing and kind of making this argument of bread and butter politics.
It's Ayesha Roscoe, White House reporter for NPR. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ten years ago, the largest immigration raid at a single site in the U.S. took place in the city of Postville, Iowa. The economy of Postville, which has a population of around 2,100 people, was and is largely based around a meat processing plant there, then called agriprocessors. Many of the workers at that plant were undocumented. So what did that raid do to Postville? That's the subject of a new Univision documentary called America First, The Legacy of an Immigration Raid. And joining us now is Almudena Toral, who produced the film. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
And first of all, just set the scene for us. What is Postville like?
It's a tiny town, 2,000 people, more or less. It was founded in 1843 by German immigrants. It's an agricultural town in the middle of Iowa with a meatpacking plant that's the main employer in the town. It's a peaceful rolling hills corn town, a lot of very cold in winter.
And the raid that you focus on at the meatpacking plant happened in May of 2008. This is during the Bush administration. What happened?
So it's a normal day in Postville, Iowa, when around 10 a.m. people described that they were hearing helicopters. Kids in school, people at their jobs, they were hearing helicopters rounding up the town. This is very unusual for such a tiny town. And then about 1,000 ICE agents descended on agriprocessors, the meatpacking plant in this town, and what started was the biggest immigration raid in U.S. history. 389 immigrants were detained, of which 287 ended up being deported, mostly to Guatemala.
And the other 100 or so, what happened to them?
Some of them, mostly women who had small children and nobody else who could take care of them, were able to stay and stay free, return to their families with ankle monitors. So they had to be monitored regularly. They couldn't work, but they were able to stay. And some of them were able to legalize their status eventually.
Why were there so many undocumented immigrant workers in this particular plant?
This particular plant was very controversial. There were a lot of issues going on at this plant, not only immigration related. The president of the company, Shalom Rubashkin, who is an Orthodox Jew from New York, had a lot of financial dealings going on. He ended up serving time in prison for 86 counts of financial fraud. But he didn't end up serving time for the immigration violations. There were minors that were working at the plant. There were sexual abuse cases that were documented. There was a lot of things going on at the plant that were just not right.
Mm. And so you focus in the documentary about the impacts of this raid on the town. What were the biggest ones?
The demographic impact was huge. The town lost almost half of its population after the raid. It was also devastating economically. The plant that was the main economic motor of the town went bankrupt and later reopened under a foreign owner. Many workers didn't get paid for months and eventually lost their jobs. A lot of local businesses closed down. The whole county, not only the town, suffered. Immigrants and non-immigrants alike. That's what we heard during our reporting for months.
One of the interesting things, though, is that even though this town has so many immigrants in it, some of the people there really do believe that they should be sent back to the countries that they came from. This is a young man that you talked to named Drew Lubka, whose sister is dating a DACA recipient, and he had this to say.
We need to make sure people are here only if they're supposed to be here. I'm not saying that all these people are bad. There's a lot of good ones, but as a whole, I feel their community is negatively affecting our town. They just kind of keep to themselves, and they're not integrating well.
Is that a common conception there?
Well, in this town has a high percentage of immigrants, but still the county where it's located at voted majority for Trump, over 58% for Trump. And it wasn't unusual. We met a lot of Trump supporters. The interesting thing is that a lot of them voted for Trump on a one-issue basis. So some of the ones that lived in Postville were pro-immigration, but, for example, the economics and jobs was a huge issue for them, so they voted for him that way, or national security, some of the Jewish people. So, yes, it's common that that clash happens there all the time.
There's one girl that you focus on in this film whose father gets deported in this raid. But she ends up staying in the U.S. and you see her at the dentist's office and her parents are nowhere nearby. I mean, what about the kids who ended up there by themselves without their parents after a raid like this? Maybe the kids who were even born in the U.S., they're U.S. citizens.
That was, personally for me, was the most heartbreaking effect to see, the effect on children who leave the raid, whose parents got deported or even didn't get deported, but they managed to stay with long-term consequences, immigration-wise, and with legal consequences. The effect on kids is dramatic. There's been studies in Postville about low fertility rates afterwards and the psychological impact it had on children. In this case, the girl that we profiled, her name is Heidi. She is the only one in her family that was born in the U.S. Her family is from Guatemala. Her dad was arrested and put in prison for 6 months and later deported during the Postville raid. Her mom, also undocumented, wasn't at the meatpacking plant, but got really, really scared and ended up going back to Guatemala with the other, with the girls, with the daughters. And the difference is striking. Heidi's sisters in Guatemala don't even go to school. One of them is 5 years old, the other one is 15, and the other one is 16. So she has the whole pressure of sustaining her family in the future. There's a lot of hopes put on her, but it's also extremely difficult psychologically for her. She even mentions at some point in the documentary, I don't even have anybody to give me hugs.
Right.
And to see that girl just going through life in the United States by herself was really heartbreaking.
What about the company? What happened to the company? It's filed for bankruptcy. Somebody else had to take it over. What happened to the owner who employed all those people?
The owner who employed all those people, Shalom Rubashkin, went to prison. He was sentenced to 27 years in prison for 86 counts of financial fraud, not related to the immigration violations. Although in December of last year, Donald Trump condoned his sentence and he was set free. The current owner is Canadian. He's not American. And the plant reopened after a little while. They really struggled to find workers. They brought workers from the most unexpected places all over the country, rehab centers, homeless shelters. They even brought Pacific Islanders from Palau. And none of it worked. They didn't end up staying. It's dangerous and hard work. So at the end, hundreds of Somali refugees ended up arriving in Postville, Iowa, and filled those jobs, that void that was left by the deported workers.
Now, this raid, as we said, happened during the Bush administration, but you are releasing this documentary during the Trump administration at a time when he and his administration have gotten very tough on illegal immigration. Are raids like this happening with regularity now?
Yes, it's very interesting and very timely because Donald Trump has increased massive worksite raids again. After the Postville raid under the Bush administration, there was only one big immigration raid at a worksite that had already been planned. So Bush executed it. But after that, the outrage, the public outrage about these raids and the efficiency of it was so loud that they stopped doing them. So there's been raids, of course, at homes and other places, but not on work sites at this scale. Until now, with the Donald Trump administration, we've seen over the last few months several massive work site raids, just like the one in Postville, in Ohio, in Tennessee. And I think we'll expect to be seeing more of them.
And what message do you want people who watch your documentary to take away about those raids?
I would like to think about, and I think this documentary can really shed light on the efficiency of these worksite enforcement operations. When we think about, are they really efficient? This raid in 2008 cost over $5 million that came out of taxpayer pockets. And what did it achieve? Those jobs did not go back to Americans. They went to Somali refugees. Some of the people that were deported ended up coming back. It cost a lot of distraught to children and to the economy of that town and the county in general. When you look at the overall efficiency of what the raid accomplished, one really questions, was it really worth it? So I think some of those lessons can be really applied to what's been happening now and hopefully raises some an intelligent conversation about if it's worth the cost of these massive worksite operations.
It's Almudena Torral of Univision on her new documentary, America First. We'll have a link on our website. Almudena, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today, the world's largest maker of heavy equipment for construction, mining, and energy announced record earnings per share for the second quarter. Illinois-based Caterpillar also said it's going to have to raise prices because of tariffs. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And let's start with the good news for Caterpillar. What is giving them this earnings boost?
Well, they've had very strong machinery sales, and that is because the global economy has really picked up. And specifically, we know that there's been great demand for construction and infrastructure in China, and they've got to build that stuff. And Caterpillar builds the equipment. And in North America, growth is helped by the demand for construction equipment, which has been related to the demand from the oil and gas sector. So you put it together, it was just a beautiful quarter, except for that one piece that you talked about, which is
tariffs.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. So what are they saying about that? They plan to raise prices because of tariffs.
Yeah, they said that those tariffs are likely to increase costs for the rest of the year by up to $200 million. So not an insignificant amount. The company said it's going to try to offset much of that through a mid-year price increase. So, you know, this is one of those pieces of information around the tariffs that we were worried about. We were worried that the tariffs in and of themselves might lead to higher prices for the producers, the wholesalers, and then they would pass that along to the end user. Or the consumer or the business, right, in this case. And that's what we're seeing.
I also noticed that they plan to do more buying back of their own shares. rather than, or I mean, maybe they're also doing this, but they're not talking about it, raising wages for their workers.
Yeah, this is a share buyback program that is slated to begin next year. $10 billion worth of a share buyback program. And, you know, that really is probably linked to the corporate tax cut that occurred. Mm-hmm. And, you know, listen, maybe they will pay their workers a little bit more, but as many economists and analysts had predicted, the tax cut for companies, it may be used to fuel some internal growth, but it would mostly be used to reward shareholders, mm-hmm. whether through buybacks or dividends.
We also got some news today regarding tariffs about Tyson Foods. What happened there?
Well, Tyson cut its full-year profit guidance and is directly related to the tariffs and the uncertainty of the commodity markets, meaning the meat and the pork markets. Tyson's stock touched a 52-week low this morning when this was announced. They say the fundamentals of their business are strong, but this is really uncertainty creeping into a business. And unlike Caterpillar, Tyson is quite clearly going to suffer much more dramatic and direct consequences from these tariffs immediately.
Now, on the issue of Caterpillar, it's not a company that we talk about as much as, say, Facebook or Amazon these days, but still a very important American company. What does it tell us about the state of the economy, do you think?
Well, I think that the general theme is that the economy is doing well. We had a very strong GDP report for the second quarter. Caterpillar is a Fortune 100 company. It sells big industrial machinery and equipment, and it kind of reflects the overall growth of not just the U.S. economy, but the world mm-hmm. economy. Not as flashy as a Facebook or a Twitter, but then again, not down 20% in a single day.
That's
either.
Right. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News. Thank you.
Thank you.
Officials from Russia, Iran, and Turkey are meeting in the Black Sea resort of Sochi this week to discuss the civil war in Syria. One of the biggest issues is the humanitarian crisis triggered by the conflict, which is now more than 7 years old. Millions of civilians fled to neighboring countries, Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey, and millions more are displaced inside Syria. Our next guest has been trying to help. Dr. Zaher Salul is president and co-founder of the relief organization Med Global, and he joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, I wonder if we might begin with the people who have fled Syria. I mean, where have you been recently and what have you seen?
A couple of weeks ago, I was in Jordan and I visited a city called Al-Mafraq, which is on the border of the Syrian-Jordanian area. And there was a free zone between Al-Mafraq and Syria, which had numbers of IDPs. These are internally displaced people from the recent bombing of Daraa, and these are Syrians who tried to get into Jordan, but they were blocked. We visited some of the injured Syrians who were allowed into Jordanian hospitals. One of them was a child. His name was Aus, who was 15 months, who was injured in the Syrian regime bombing of his house in a city called Seda, east of Daraa. And his family fled to the border areas, and they were allowed in to seek treatment for Aus. And there were about 160 injured Syrians who were allowed into Jordan. Mm. In the past couple of years, I visited, of course, refugees, Syrian refugees in Jordan, in Al-Za'atari camp, in Al-Azraq camp, and we did multiple medical missions there.
Ah. Now, do hospitals have supplies and equipment they need to treat all the injured and wounded?
In Jordan, yes. I mean, Jordan is a very advanced country in terms of healthcare. The doctors are well equipped to deal with the war injuries that they receive from Syria. In general, Jordan have provided what they can provide. They have about 650,000 Syrian refugees who are registered, and probably the same number who are not registered. And Syrians have fled to Jordan for the past 7 years, and in general, the situation is okay for them. But of course, many of them would like to go back when the situation is safer in Syria. Mm.
Well, so, I mean, given the numbers you just said, that's about 1.3 million refugees in Jordan, registered and unregistered. What is their biggest need right now?
The most important need is the actually political transition in Syria so they can go back. Every Syrian refugees, refugee I've met in Jordan wanted to go back, but they wanted to have political transition and settlement in Syria. They wanted to have a guarantee of their safety. They wanted to have assurances that the villages and the cities they fled from are rebuilt. And this is not happening, of course, until now in Syria. There is still a lot of violence, especially from the Syrian regime at the areas that are controlled by the rebels. The Syrian regime recently have released documents of people who died under torture in Syria. There are about 13,000 of them. This is a huge number of Syrians who died under torture in the Assad's prisons. And people do not feel safe to go back to a country that has been, you know, killing people under torture in this industrial level. Of course, what they need in Jordan also more attention. They wanted to have, you know, especially for the children, which are about 50% of the refugees in Jordan, they need education, proper education. People need health care, and recently the level of assistance from the international community have been dwindling, and we need to pay more attention to the refugees in Jordan and also in Lebanon. Lebanon is another country that I visited a couple of months ago, and the situation of the Syrian refugees in Lebanon is even worse than Jordan because Lebanon is a small country. One out of four of the people in Lebanon is a Syrian refugee, about 1.5 million. And they need all kind of support in Lebanon.
Yeah. Well, I just want to play a little bit of tape for you because on Friday we spoke with Lise Doucette. She's the BBC's chief international correspondent, and she's been covering the Syrian conflict since its beginning. And we talked to her about, you know, what might happen next now that it seems as President Assad's forces are retaking just about all the rebel-held territory in Syria, and what that might mean for the refugees who have fled the country. So let's listen to what Lise said.
The question is whether President Assad wants people to come back now, whether there's a place for people to come back now, whether it's safe to come back, but also it's about the kind of population. People will come back. Some of them would have been people who supported the uprising, although they won't want to talk about that or be identified with that. Syria is a country which needs money for reconstruction. So these are political and financial issues.
Dr. Salul, I'm wondering, I mean, for all the people that you spoke with, you said everyone wanted to go home, but would they even have a place to go to?
Some of them do. I mean, I spoke with Syrian businessmen and doctors who fled the crisis in Syria and the Assad regime in particular, and they want to go back, and they have homes. They have their neighborhoods are still intact in some of the cities like Damascus and Homs and Aleppo, but they want the guarantee of their safety. They want to have political settlement, and they want to make sure they want to have assurances by the international community that they will not be persecuted, which is the case right now in some of the refugees who are going or pushed to return from Lebanon and other places to Syria. There is no guarantee of their safety. The Syrian regime have been especially targeting young men in military age for draft. And actually, if we're seeing in some of the instances, like in the city of Homs and other places, people fleeing now, even at that there is no violence because they don't want to be drafted in a military that they consider been targeting their people. So this level of safety is not there. Of course, they need, some of them want to go to a place that there is houses. There's about 4 million houses in Syria that were destroyed, mostly by the Assad and the Russian regimes. Some neighborhoods in my city, Homs, were completely leveled. And until now, after the Assad regime asserted its control on the city of Homs, these same neighborhoods are not built and people are not allowed to go back to it.
Hmm. I mean, what you just said, this has been such an awful conflict. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people dead, millions displaced. I'm just wondering, do you think that the world, the international community has failed Syria and Syrians?
I think every Syrian I speak to and spoke to in the past 7 years, and I lived the crisis like many Syrians in every minute, feel that we were let down by the international community, especially by my country, by the United States of America. We shut the door in the faces of Syrian refugees. We allowed only 18,000 Syrian refugees. And let's remember that there's 5.5 million Syrian refugees. Much smaller countries have accepted larger number of Syrian refugees. We did not support the Syrians humanitarianly. We did not engage in the crisis at the political level to force a political transition. We have United Nations Security Council Resolution 2254 that speaks for a political transition in Syria. That resolution happened in 2012. Until now, we don't have any political process that will lead to that endpoint. In general, this administration in particular did not care about the Syrian people. And lately, they've been talking about disengagement from Syria completely, which will be a disaster. So what every Syrian American and Syrian I spoke to would like to see is more attention to the plight of the Syrian civilians, and not only talking about Syria in the term of crisis and terrorism and ISIS and protection of our allies, but speaking about the people as humans who deserve our attention, who deserve our protection, who deserve to live in dignity. Let's not forget that in 2011, Syrian people went into peaceful demonstrations to ask for freedom, for dignity, for jobs, the same way that we in the United States have. And they've been punished severely by their own government, brutally persecuted, shot at in the demonstration, pushed to carry arms. And right now, everyone is trying to ignore them and act as things are back to normal. This should not happen.
Dr. Zaher Salul is president and co-founder of the relief organization Med Global. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Meghna.
The future isn't looking so bright right now for some of the world's biggest social media companies. Facebook's stock took a major dive last Thursday, dropping 19% after saying it expected slower growth. Twitter stock also fell around 20% after it reported negative user growth on Friday. Obviously, this is a problem for these companies, but it also raises questions about the entire internet advertising industry, which is to say the entire advertising industry. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Jeremy.
So let's start with these companies first. They are, you know, very big social media companies. We talk about them all the time. How much are they actually hurting based on what's happened in the last week?
Well, they're hurting to the extent that two companies with more than 2 billion users worldwide, worth more than $500 billion in market cap, can be hurting. Yes, they are hurting. When your stock declines by 20% in a day, I think that qualifies under the financial definition of hurting. It was a terrible week for these companies. And for Facebook in particular, it's worth just spending one more moment on this. Facebook suffered the worst single-day drop in market cap of any company in American history.
One of the reasons that Facebook is dealing with the loss of users is that they are, you know, dumping fake users. Twitter's doing that. They're dealing with people who post offensive content, which is something mm-hmm. that everyone has been telling them to do. But it sounds like Wall Street is punishing them in part for that.
I'm really happy that you framed it like that, because what has happened in the last few days is, one, Twitter purged its platform of fake accounts and its value dropped. And then, two, Facebook announced that it's going to crack down on privacy concerns and ramp up on monitoring abuse and harmful propaganda, and its value right. dropped. So in both cases, the companies are essentially saying, we're going to spend more on removing junk. And investors said, goodbye. And this tells me a few things. Like, one, part of Twitter and Facebook's market value was, you have to say, built on junk. There's no getting around that point. These social media companies were more valuable when they were protecting the illusion of transparency and the illusion of quality rather than the actual thing. Number two, the stock market is officially a bet on the future earnings potential of its companies. And here you have investors saying, we don't want to be a part of these two companies that are in the process of cleaning themselves up. And that just tells me something very fundamental and depressing about the social media advertising world, which is that the very effort to clean it up is now being explicitly punished.
And when you say the social media advertising world, at this point, how big is that world? How important are Twitter and Facebook to the entire advertising industry?
The truth is that Twitter is not that important to the entire digital advertising world. And when I said social media advertising world, what I should have said was Facebook, because Facebook is the monolith of social media advertising, especially when you include all of its sub-kingdoms. You've got Facebook. They also own Instagram. They also own WhatsApp. Facebook and Google have for many years been called the duopoly. That is, the two giants that control digital advertising. I think right now they control about 60% of all digital advertising. And a year ago, they accounted for over 90% of the growth in digital advertising. So for every dollar that's going toward advertising on apps and on desktop and on mobile, over 90 cents of that dollar are going to two companies. You also have Amazon sort of coming up the rear to maybe turn the duopoly into a triumvirate. But you basically have the entire advertising industry extremely reliant on the business model of a handful of companies, and it's a big deal when one of those companies has such a terrible day, in fact, the worst trading day in the history of U.S. stock markets.
Well, and if you're trying to advertise, digital advertising is where it's at, because you can figure out much more precisely who you are targeting and what they've been doing and what their interests are, and you have a higher likelihood of them actually buying your product. So what does it mean for advertising and media overall if growth is stalling at Facebook?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. So I like to think about it historically. Facebook underwent a huge shift around the time of its IPO. There was a huge concern that Facebook had built a business model around desktop, and then all these users were switching to mobile phones. They had to build a mobile business. And now they have a mobile advertising business that is the envy of the world, or at least the entire world except for Google. Now it's undergoing another shift, and that shift is from news feeds, those familiar waterfalls of content that you see on your phone and on your desktop when you go to Facebook.com, from news feeds to stories, those little mini movies you see on Snapchat or on Instagram. As younger users essentially shift from feeds to stories, Facebook has to again shift its advertising business model from a vertical waterfall to a more horizontal stream or film. And as it tries to figure that out, I think its earnings are going to suffer a little bit. But again, the reason that I'm not entirely bearish on Facebook's future is that, you know what company dominates the social media world when it comes to stories? It's Instagram, which is owned by Facebook. So these users are, it's like, you know, people in the U.S. moving from New York to Texas. It doesn't mean the U.S. population is declining. It just means the population is shifting.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.